I don't know that I have anything particular that I see that needs to be covered about being at UCSC, and would just leave it, you know, kind of an open question. What do you think was important about that 4 years, or take it that you did it in 4 years, or maybe only three? I don't know. You want to? I'm sorry, we're on. Do you want to...
No, I didn't realize we were back on.
Explicit.
Yeah, I was thinking about something
else. It's like tapping your phone if I don't say...
Yeah.
So we are...
So Santa Cruz.
You already mentioned generally, like, teachers, again, like high school people, particular people influencing, or just opening up your eyes to things. But other than that, again, I don't know that...
I mean, we could spend days, you know, talking about... college, because it's such a formative time for everybody.
No
exception for me.
I just don't have a particular. Okay, then I would ask so you know, what was the most what was the most formative thing that happened to you?
No, that doesn't count.
That doesn't work. You want to answer that one?
You were saying, what do I want to say about Santa Cruz?
Sure.
Okay. One of the premises, really, or one of the ideas that the place is based on is that the students are actually trusted to know what's important or find out what's important. Certainly, I mean, there are course requirements for majors and things like that, but there are less requirements, or when I was there, there were fewer requirements than many other places. And so...
You mean just like that instead of 5 or 6 core courses or something, you know, to be a chem major, there were maybe...
There were fewer, right.
That you had to do projects or something or whatever, and you would design those with the...
Well, also there were courses that either were required or strongly recommended in each of the colleges. And in my college, which is Crown College, there was a component on science and Western civilization, and taught by very dynamic, faculty, just people who...
Who were they? Were they historians? I mean, philosophers, scientists, biologists? I mean, or was it
Dick Olson, history of science, Peter Eubin, politics, Jack Schar, politics. I think those were the main people.
It's kind of like a core. I mean, it was a...
Yeah, Schar was in Cal, but... or he was in a different college, but Olson and Eubin taught the Crown core courses.
And all of them. I mean, like, really, you know, you couldn't possibly be in Crown without running into them at least once.
No, you could have. They weren't required, but they were part of, you know, the college offering, part of the college identity, and a lot of people took them.
And what would the, do you recall what you were... reading, or what they were discussing, or what?
Oh God, you know, Herbert Marcuse and Plato and Aristotle, and Hegel, Kant.
They're more, you know, esoteric theories of Nietzsche. Knowledge and science, or they're more, you know, political theory, or
Thomas
all of
Kuhn. Yeah, I mean, it goes through. It started with the Greeks. Let me put it that way. So it was philosophy and history. And the relationship of technical development and ideas to political ideas and processes. And really the role of science in Western civilization. So I remember being so immersed in this for one quarter that I didn't really do much work in the lab. So I started research in a chemistry lab in my sophomore year. A friend of mine from freshman year had gone off to Cold Spring Harbor to be in the undergraduate program there, and he came back thinking it was really great.
It was just a summer sort of program?
Summer program, right.
Was it competitive kind of thing, or just you
competitive,
just
yeah, really, really competitive. He worked with a guy who was involved in discovering restriction enzymes. And so it was really early days of restriction enzymes, and he just had a
who
blast.
Was it? You don't recall it?
Roberts. So he came back and said, gee, you know, you really ought to do research if you're at all interested in science, because that's what it's about, and you better find out if you like it.
He was more straight in biologist as opposed to a chemist, or...
Yeah, his major was biology.
Okay. And you really were a chem major. You weren't a biochem major, or you didn't...
I was not declared until later. Yeah.
That you would even set the lab work aside to get into reading Aristotle and Marcuse. Which I, you know...
Well, it wasn't that. It was so threatening, really.
The content of the course.
Material. Yeah, the intellectual idea is that, you know, science is the enemy and is the source of problems rather than solutions to problems.
That was the perspective of the Olson and Yuval. That was what you were getting out of, like, reading Aristotle's Politics or Kant, I'm sure.
Well, that was certainly a lot of the a lot of the content of some of the readings that we did.
You mean the second, I mean people writing about these folks, or this was all just primary?
Well, you read Marcuse and you go, oh, well,
this is opinions.
Yeah, this is interesting. And, you know, if you're thinking about maybe being a scientist or doing science, and you're reading somebody who says that this is not anything but a socially destructive activity, then...
Wasn't that maybe kind of countered by other, either the writings themselves? I mean, I don't think Kant would have really come out and said, you know, basically that... his concepts certainly of how people organize, even just organize knowledge, and therefore put scientists at the top of a certain kind of or put scientific knowledge at the top. I mean, it's all supposed to be very rigorously rational. It was necessarily a negative thing. I mean, he may have been critical of certain parts of it or whatnot, but there must have been some counterweight to something like Marcuse. Or, I mean, even Kuhn seems to me as somebody trying to be more balanced in that approach.
Right. I would say that the authors that I listed were authors that I read over the course of 3 or 4 years in college.
Right. Okay.
And they weren't all the same quarter, so you didn't get this balanced feeling, essentially. And
Olson and Newman had a specific kind of, again, a slant to that.
Yeah, I mean...
You
know, I was
like
a freshman in college. I was a sophomore in college, and like what? I didn't have a framework really to put their perspective into. It was just what we were studying, what we were reading in class, and that what I was trying to do is develop that framework. And you know, I mean, it seems obvious now, but I didn't really understand the difference between sort of political decisions and uses of technology that occur in a democracy versus the idea that there's a technological imperative that, you know, if something is possible, it happens. And therefore, it's the fault of the person who developed the technology. The events are the fault of the scientist or the engineer who, say, developed the atom bomb,
mm-hmm.
and not that a political decision was taken in a particular historical context to use this technology in a certain way.
do you kind of see it as a kind of two opposed ways of one that absolves the scientists from the work and the, or the results of or the uses of such knowledge, or versus one that implicates them as the major person to whom fault should go? Or are you saying you kind of came to an equilibrium and saw those as extreme?
That's an equilibrium, yeah. And I would say, yes, you as a scientist, you have to take responsibility for the uses of your particular research. But you don't always know ahead of time what those uses are going to be. And then as a citizen, you have to participate in deciding at whatever level how the world is going to be, whether it be the uses of technical knowledge that you had something to do with, or maybe most of it, of course, you have nothing to do with. I guess, you know, personally, I wouldn't work on developing weapons intentionally, you know, in our current political situation, you know.
You put it up the hill.
Yeah, exactly.
Up the hill is
a weapons lab.
It's a weapons lab.
But, and you know, I don't agree with the decisions of the people who decided to do that with their lives, or do that with their lives.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't anymore see science itself as the enemy and as a destructive force. I mean, I see human beings as making stupid decisions about how to use the information, but
do you see that as, I think this is, you know, really fascinating, and I guess
it's kind of philosophical, though.
I certainly think that's as important as talking about the particular work you did in the lab, you know, and the importance of certain kinds of work you did in your lab, but also your, just how you see that fitting into a much larger context.
Well, so I think the point to make really is
a little bit.
Yeah, the point to make is that, I mean, I was exposed to these ideas. By the time I was a senior in college, I took a course called the Sources of Anti-Science. And it was taught by Olson, historian of science. And, you know, we read Tolstoy and other sources that argued that scientific rigor was antithetical to the human spirit. And it was also destructive of social relations. Certainly as a scientist, you feel that. I mean, all those hours in the lab and late at night and there aren't other people around and you feel alienated. That's for sure. And so there's some resonance with, you know, each person's personal experience and the fact that you spend a lot of time by yourself. On the other hand, by the time I took that course as a senior, I was doing the reading mostly to become informed rather than as a threat to my own day-to-day activities. Mm-hmm. And what I was saying is when I first was exposed to these ideas as a sophomore,
you were kind of scared.
I just didn't go to the lab anymore. I mean, I
stopped.
Yeah,
you were going to go to the lab.
Right,
later.
Exactly. I mean, if an undergraduate student in my lab did that now, I would be completely intolerant. I mean, I would be pissed.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, so I really credit my undergraduate lab and research advisor for being incredibly tolerant.
What was this? Maybe you said his name.
No, I haven't said his name. It's Tony Fink.
Of course, I shouldn't say and, that it was he, but I guess I didn't.
I didn't get much done in Tony's lab.
Do you think that's the function of undergraduates in labs anyway, is productivity, or do you think it's kind of like continuing the line? You know what I mean? Exposure and so that you kind of catch these people who may be curious at the right time and kind of help them into the process of becoming a scientist?
I don't expect undergraduates in my lab to be very productive, and maybe that's just because I wasn't. I have had very productive undergraduates in my lab. I like to have undergraduates in my lab because they're often very thoughtful.
You mean that they get other people to stop and think? Or they're...
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question.
They're very thoughtful. You mean they get the rest of the people in the lab, they kind of maybe put the brakes on them so they stop and think as well, or...
No, they make me stop and think.
Okay. I don't care about the rest of the damn people in the lab, right?
No, it's not that.
Let them find their own way. Of,
I think what happens more often than not is that graduate students in the lab or postdocs in the lab are more concerned with putting out the product. And it's not that I'm not concerned with putting out the product, but they're not really worried about undergraduate education or concerned about what these people are getting out of their experience in the same way that you know, I would really like them to be able to think about a problem and become more linear and start to learn how to do science rather than just to stuff these little facts in their brains.
If we could follow this through, do you have undergrads here?
Well, my lab here is very new, so we're not really set up, and I have not taken undergraduates here, but I've had really good undergraduates in Salt Lake. Okay. Yeah, and I always had undergraduates in the lab in Salt Lake.
And they just found you, as opposed to you, or you really look for them, or...
There's some of both. In Salt Lake, I would approach TAs in certain courses and say, who's good,
and then go talk to them,
yeah.
That was kind of an ego thing as well for them, I'm sure, you know, oh, here's the big prof is maybe even just, you know, a little bit interested in, no, I mean, that's a good...
Well, it's a different different culture there. I mean, if you're at Berkeley or if you're at MIT or someplace, the profs are considered big profs, whether they're big or little. But if you're at Oregon or at a...
It doesn't matter, they're all up.
At Utah, it's a medium-level state university, and the people are there for very individual reasons, and the culture is different.
I mean, to be there for student education.
I don't mean the faculty. I mean the students.
Oh, okay.
Okay, the student culture at Berkeley may be more intellectual, or at MIT, maybe the students are thinking they're there to learn what's at the cutting edge and to become well paid or famous
mm-hmm.
engineers and scientists, in Berkeley, it's broader, historians or whatever, deal with the great ideas. There are students like that at Utah, but it's not the dominant culture in any sense.
I guess I didn't mean it in a flattering sense, but just that somebody would be approached by the professor of a course as opposed to just the TA, and, would you be interested in work? I mean, that must be a... kind of a boost about.
Oh yeah.
Someone notices my work or my interest, and that's
yeah.
I mean, if there was a spark there, that may ignite it, or whatever. That's
yeah.
Not maybe a good metaphor because it doesn't make much sense.
So my undergraduate research experience was on enzyme reactions, the mechanisms.
So you just sought this guy Fink out. I mean, after your friend kind of told you what a great time he had at
Cold Spring Harbor,
and how you shouldn't miss this if you were really going to do it this way.
So I made a list of people that I might be interested in and went around to each of them, and Fink was the first person that said yes. Right? And it was nothing more informed than that. I mean... Anyway.
And you stayed in that lab for
3 years? Yeah, for 3 years.
Okay. Except for maybe a couple of... weeks in yourself,
of quarters.
You, quarters where you just were kind of wondering about doing that.
Yeah, and I worked summers in the lab, so that
paid. I take it.
It paid not very much, enough to live for the summer, and kept me from going back to L.A.
Yes. You just didn't like the city compared to the country, I guess is how to think, you know.
No, it's hard to be independent and on your own in college and then go back and be with your parents. Mm-hmm. Or in my case, it was with my mother.
Mm-hmm.
And the thought of, you know, her telling me what to do.
Or the thought maybe, you know, if she was maybe living alone. It's
difficult.
Or maybe she was, I don't know, she was married.
No, she didn't remarry. No, she was living alone.
So, yeah, that may have been also different from then. A lot of people who maybe went home with six other kids in the family and,
yeah,
you know, kind of parents in and out the door, and that they were just, you know, one more person to be part of the family, whereas your return may have been like, you know, you doubled the population in a sense, you know.
Well, the first summer in college, I did go back to Los Angeles, and she spent much of the summer in Europe, and so that actually made it quite easy. And I worked painting houses, but
and this is still the same apartment you moved into.
Yeah, but it was a small place and pretty small for both of us.
Okay.
By the time you know, I was off on my own. So I really liked being in Santa Cruz for the summers, and I worked in the lab. But, And Tony's lab was concerned with understanding how enzymes speed up chemical reactions. And the thing that was very lucky for me is that his approach involved developing a new way to study this process. And specifically, he was studying enzyme reactions at very low temperatures. And the idea was that at low temperature, the reactions would be slow enough, or in fact almost stopped, so that you could observe intermediates in the reactions using spectrophotometric techniques. And the controversial part of the work was that to keep the whole system liquid, I mean, enzymes work in liquid, to keep things from freezing, he would transfer these proteins to mixtures of water and DMSO, or basically water and organic solvent, so water and DMSO or ethanol or methanol. And so his work was criticized because proteins generally don't work in the presence of, people had thought that these proteins don't work in the presence of organic solvents. There aren't organic solvents in cells to the same concentrations. And so,
I don't want to say almost fleeting, but that's not scientific either. These solvents, that they're just there for the moment that they're needed, or that they're, you know, that they're produced.
Like ethanol is a byproduct of metabolism in certain cells, but you don't get to 60% ethanol.
Right.
The cells die by the time you get there, right?
It disappears quite quickly. I take it it's there in some sort of part of the process, but immediately broken down again. Or
yeah, whatever. Exactly.
Okay.
So the work was viewed with a great deal of skepticism because people felt that maybe some of the results that were being obtained were artifacts of the high concentrations of organic solvents. And so that was a constant challenge in the lab, that people did experiments to try to show that the events that were being observed under these sort of bizarre conditions reflected events that you would observe a lot faster in water alone. And so, anyway, my sort of contribution isn't the right word, but my interest was sort of piqued by discussions in the lab where people would say things like, well, it's interesting that we have the absorbance spectrum of this intermediate and this enzyme reaction, and that indicates that this chemical group is in a more hydrophobic environment in this intermediate, but we don't know exactly where it is. And what we'd really like to know is, what is the three-dimensional structure of this intermediate? That is, we want to know the X-ray crystal structure of this enzyme sort of caught in the act of catalyzing a reaction, and you sort of trap the intermediate by lowering the temperature enough that there's just not enough energy for it to break down. So in my senior year, I started to try to see if crystalline enzymes could be induced to start chemical reactions and then stop. That is, could you trap intermediates in enzymatic reactions when the enzymes were in crystals rather than being in solution?
So you'd make them in, let's say, a normal time, in the quote, normal way that some of them were being made, the crystals, right?
Right.
In other situations, in other labs, and then throw them into this.
Right, that is,
you
would want to have the crystalline organic solvent. You cool it down and add the substrate that normally would be broken down in a few milliseconds, and then see if you could show that the reaction was trapped, say, halfway through.
And they were doing crystallography work in Fink's lab.
Not at all. That was the problem. And what I was about to say is we had no idea how to grow crystals.
And you were an undergrad and you just decided you'd go do this? Or you figured it out?
Well, that was the information that people in the lab really talked about it, and it would come up over the years again and again. Well, we've got this information, and it's telling us this about this step and this reaction,
but we
need to do is X-ray crystallography and figure out how to do it at these low temperatures. And so we didn't know how to grow crystals. I didn't know how to grow crystals, and so, in fact, I didn't grow crystals. Instead, what I did was to make precipitates of proteins where the protein was still solid, but it was just an amorphous precipitate, and started doing experiments. They were pretty off the main stream in the lab.
Yeah.
And so I ended up getting time on the equipment late at night, and so I strung a climbing hammock from the rafters and would take time points through the night, basically, by reaching over and taking a pipette and taking a sample out and then analyzing it. It was bizarre. But what happened at that time was a person in Oxford, Greg Petsko, had started to develop methods to do crystallography in organic aqueous organic solvents at low temperature.
Now, he had read Fink's work. He was
no
a whole other area of people trying to.
Yeah, so it was a very small field. One of the proponents was a man named Pierre Duzu in Paris, and Petsko had met Duzu, and so Petsko was in David Phillips' lab at Oxford, and so Phillips and Petsko started to try to show that you could transfer crystals to solvents that would stay liquid below zero, and that the crystals would still diffract X-rays. Petsko published a paper on this in the early 70s, he and Fink communicated,
do you know who initiated that? Was that Fink or?
I used to know. I don't remember, to tell you the truth.
Okay. But obviously, with a small enough group of people working in the field, and both of them kind of realizing they were interested in an area where other people were going, this is insane, or this is wrong way to go, that certainly they would have found each other out sooner or later.
Yeah.
Pretty quickly. Followed each other's work for a while.
Yeah. So what happened was that I ended up going to Petsko's lab. He had moved to Wayne State. Mm-hmm. I had sort of amassed enough credits to take a quarter off and go to Wayne State Greg was doing an experiment on a crystal of elastase and trying to, this is a serine protease, trying to trap an intermediate inner crystal at low temperature. And I had done very similar experiments with these precipitates with a different serine protease. And Fink and Petzko decided they should collaborate, and and so then I got to go out to Detroit.
So you were paid? Somebody, I mean, they gave you a...
No, I was an undergraduate, so I wasn't paid.
So you got credit?
Yeah, I got credit. Mm-hmm. And I got...
Which you didn't need, obviously, right? Because you had extra...
Well, I did, actually. I needed a course to get all the requirements for my chemistry major. Mm-hmm. I didn't need the credits, but I needed a particular course that was only offered in the winter quarter, and it was physical chemistry lab. And they accepted the notion that working in an X-ray crystallography lab was equivalent to physical chemistry lab. And so I got out to Detroit. And that in itself was an amazing experience. It was sort of my urban urban blight experience. I lived in the inner city.
LA doesn't count. Yeah. It was urban, sort of.
Yeah, yeah.
Not blight.
So Wayne State University is inner city Detroit, and I lived right near campus, and you know, there was a red light district down the street, mm-hmm. and the Burger King had an armed guard behind the counter to prevent robberies, and people were definitely afraid.
Well, and then Detroit, the racial disturbances in Detroit had been rather later than the other ones, I think, right? I mean, it would still have been 4 or 5 years earlier, though.
It was earlier, and people were still armed and still...
It was still, they were the worst, I suppose.
Very frightened, yeah.
Worse than New York and worse than Los Angeles in 1965,
yeah.
Think.
So I was there for a winter. Greg Petzko is incredibly enthusiastic and energetic, and so his style contrasted with other people I'd met. You know, and so he was a great sort of research person to work with. He had a lot of faith that even though this experiment had never been done before, that it was going to work.
And he was looking at your coming there. Not you weren't just going to be some sort of intermediary, somebody carried the communication kind of like in person back to Fink, but you had already done some of these, what we might want to term right now, kind of off the beaten track sort of experiments or work. And so you were bringing experience to Detroit with you that he wanted to at least see or see what it was you were doing. Right.
Right.
And that's kind of an odd twist, I mean, for an undergrad. I mean, you know, I'm not saying there aren't some, you know, people who got lucky maybe or were in on something that happened, but this, again, seems to be something that, you know, you either developed with Fink or you just told him this is what you thought you should do, and, you know, because you were an undergraduate, he said, yeah, sure, or he instilled in you something. I want to get a better sense of this without kind of, you know, pushing the, oh, wow, this is amazing that you're, you know, you're 18, you're 20 years old, and you're doing this, as opposed to just getting at what it is that affords even an undergraduate the chance to get at the equipment, even if you were kind of forced to do it at midnight and after.
Well, you know, I guess I feel I had a pretty small role in this. But I guess I was useful to Greg in the sense that I had at least had this experience, although I wasn't very productive. I'd had the experience of being around people who were studying enzymatic reactions at low temperatures in solution. And these types of experiments are required to define the conditions for the crystallography. That is, you have to know what temperature and how much substrate to add and whether the methanol is going to speed up the reaction so much in the crystal that it can't be observed in the time that you have to collect the data and things like that. So there's an awful lot of work for this low-temperature crystallography mm-hmm. that has to be done ahead of time to define how to do the experiment. And I'd been in the lab that define the conditions, And Greg, on the other hand, had developed the procedures or the protocols for doing the crystallography at low temperatures, mm-hmm. but hadn't dealt with all the reaction side of things at all.
Or maybe on just the one, I wrote it down.
Elastase. No, in fact, he hadn't done any of that work at all. Okay. He just figured out how to get the crystals down to low temperature. And so, in that
without
sense...
Without reacting to anything, in other words, he wasn't watching any kind of interactions.
Right,
right,
and the crystals, the challenge is to keep the crystals from disordering. They can, often when you transfer them from one solvent to another or you lower the temperature, they explode or they dissolve and you can't collect the data anymore. So he'd figured out how to do that. And, I wasn't in any sense an expert on the it's called cryoenzymology, low temperature enzymology.
But
I had just a little bit of experience, and I could get away, and so that's sort of what I was doing there. And I had no experience in crystallography.
Right. But neither did anybody else, it seems, in Finck's lab. Right?
Nobody in Finck's lab did, but of course Petzko is a very good crystallographer.
So you were going to bring that experience back, supposedly, or at least have some exposure to it, too?
No, it's a very specialized area, so I wasn't planning to bring that technique back. I mean, it can't be learned by an undergraduate in a few months. But I was just there to help with the experiment and... basically make sure everything... My role was small, so Greg sort of set things up and got him going, and he would tell me what each thing was, and I would basically try to keep the thing running. Mm-hmm. And by the end, I was getting to the point where I could start to set things up with his help. But... we would sort of trade off being there at 2 in the morning to make sure the thing didn't freeze or whatever, just while the data collection was going. And you read the numbers that come out of the computer printout, and then I would sit and plot them out and do some analysis. But, really, Greg was the person who was doing this.
And I don't mean to, suggest that, at the age of 20, you really one of the founding...
Of cryocrystallography, not at all.
Finally making the first successful. You certainly were involved in it. And I guess what I meant was that it seems to me that if Finck's work is coming under a lot of criticism, and Petzka's just kind of starting out from the other end of realizing that maybe it can be done and working on it.
Yes.
To say okay to the 20-year-old, you go there and figure this out because you're free. Still seems, and again, not. Special, not, oh, you were recognized as the next, genius in the field or anything like that, but it still seems to mean that you had already developed some sort of, scientific repertoire, biological repertoire, chemical, whatever, at the age of 20 that was advanced, and that's pretty advanced, it seems to me. And I'm trying to get maybe another way of my trying to get a sense of where that came from, or how it, getting to talk more about these weird precipitates you were doing that nobody would let you get on the equipment until late at night, so you lived in a lab in a hammock for a while.
It wasn't that bad.
You didn't take a shower in the men's gym. You went home to your dorm room every once in a while.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just saying, I did do experiments overnight. It wasn't that I lived in the lab.
And this was before you went to Wayne State that you were doing these things with the...
Yeah. But, when I applied to graduate school, I applied in history and in the sciences.
Okay.
So I was not at all, committed to being a scientist. I thought I would probably move to San Francisco with friends, get a job, and see what it was in the world that I wanted to do next.
Hang out on the hate.
Exactly. Actually, it was the mission at the time.
Oh,
well, that's where you could afford to live in San Francisco.
Well, it kind of became pretty... Well, now it seems to be back to where it was in the...
Yeah.
Just for yesterday. It's kind of stuck in time.
The hate, yeah.
Mm.
But, you know, I didn't, even when I started my senior year in college, I had this set of science courses that I'd taken. I had some research experience. I had, you know, come through some math and set that aside, and done anthropology and set that aside, and had been seduced by certain kinds of political theory, historical, what, fields, history of science.
You mean as a thing to pursue as an, like, even just maybe for fun as in an academic degree, or even as an academic?
Yeah, I mean, I had lots of interests, is all I'm saying. Mm-hmm. And an odd thing at Santa Cruz is that the faculty in the social sciences were sort of amused and encouraging that someone with a science major, a chemistry major, mm-hmm. would take these courses, and the people in the sciences didn't automatically say, "Tom, you're not focused enough." I mean, they were tolerant.
Whereas, maybe if you had one of those, you'd say...
Yeah, I mean, it was still an idea that you're there to get a broad education, not to go to a vocational school, necessarily.
So this is, in a sense, coming back for the second half of your senior year from Detroit, right?
Yeah, so I came back. So, at that point, though... after the experience in Detroit, I didn't have any question of what I wanted to do. And I had gotten a fellowship to go to graduate school. And that actually opened a lot of doors. So,
in any field or in... I mean,
it was in the sciences.
Okay, well, was that MIT?
No, it was a Danforth fellowship.
Oh, okay, so you could use it anywhere.
Yeah, actually, I could use it anywhere. So it wasn't any field. Mm-hmm. But
so you mentioned you'd applied to school for... history of science to grad school. Had you applied earlier? I mean, I'm getting the sense now when you came back from Petsko's lab and that experience, there was, like you said, no real choice or no real... you didn't have to make up your mind anymore. Your mind had been made up because of that experience.
Yeah.
But you still went ahead and applied to a few other programs, maybe just in case? Or?
Yeah. Well, it was all happening at the same time.
Okay.
So, you know, I had applied to Harvard and Cornell in
history of science.
And... it also helped that I didn't get in.
To either?
Yeah.
Huh. You think it was the UCSC thing, or...?
No, I was pretty naive.
About? You went for an interview, or you talked to professors in the programs at both places, and they just...
No, I didn't go. I didn't even get that far. My application was...
Rejected,
and it was... In retrospect, it just was very naive.
Well,
the sorts of things I was writing about. So...
Huh.
No.
I'm curious as to why that, you know.
No.
Again, somebody with your background would be. You know, I could tell maybe you flunked the GRE in history or something.
Yeah.
I wonder what their criteria, especially at Harvard and Cornell. Somebody who might write a naive application as a senior in college wouldn't be still an interesting prospect. I don't know.
But anyway, so I got this graduate fellowship, and all of a sudden, gee, I could be paid to go to graduate school, so why not? And even then, I wasn't going, you know, knowing that I was going to be a scientist. In sciences, I had just applied to places on the East Coast because I had never lived out there, and I wanted to see what it was like. So maybe to give you this will give you an idea of a little bit of an idea of where I was coming from. My two top choices were Yale and MIT, and I felt the program at Yale was more supportive, but I felt that the intellectual environment at MIT was better, and in particular the fact that Harvard was right there, and there were other schools in the Boston area would be really stimulating, because I would have time to go to lectures and
certainly for biology and chemistry and biochemistry, perhaps Cambridge was the, you know, back then the the center of the universe. So
right.
Only one of them, let's put it that way. Two or three. Maybe out here, still in the Bay Area, but
the things that attracted me were not just those fields. You know, I was essentially planning to go to lectures given by historians and people in politics and things like that. Mm-hmm. And it was really silly. You know, I got to MIT and I picked out a set of courses in the catalog like I was still an undergraduate, and I went to see my advisor and he says, "You're taking A, B, and C. Do you have any questions?" You know, and I said, "No, thank you."
Wasn't PETSCO your? I mean, was that the?
No. Greg moved to MIT during my third year there, and the advisor that I'm talking about when you first get there is just your first year academic advisor. They tell you what courses to take, and
This was the chem department there, not the
biology.
Okay, it was the biology.
Yeah.
We're coming to the end of the tape.
Okay.